From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Finally, let me say that I am more convinced than ever that war is obsolete. There may have been a time when war served as a negative good by preventing the spread and growth of evil forces, but the destructive power of modern weapons eliminates even the possibility that war may serve as a negative good.
Today is Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. He would have been 74 years old. Also, Mumia Abu-Jamal on Illinois' empty death row. And Sarah Jones, playwright, poet, actor. She takes on the FCC, the death penalty, and the immigrant experience, waking the American dream. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is warning it is time running out for Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Bush said, "I'm sick and tired of games and deception." He added, "So far, I haven't seen any evidence that he is disarming." Bush's comments come a day after weapons inspectors said they would need about 10 months to fully inspect Iraq. Inspectors have yet to find any evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Bush's words also appeared at odds with earlier comments by Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix. Blix is set to give a progress report to the UN Security Council on January 27th. He told the Washington Post that January 27th would mark the beginning of the inspection and monitoring process, not the end of it. Meanwhile, ABC News is reporting Bush is preparing to take his case for war to the United Nations soon after January 27th, regardless of the inspector's preliminary findings. And in other Iraq news, the Washington Post reports Monday was the heaviest day of U.S. and British bombings of Iraq in at least a year. Iraqi officials say six civilians were injured in five separate bombings in the north and the south. The U.S. and British call these areas no-fly zones. They are not authorized by the United Nations. Meanwhile, President Bush has offered food and energy aid to North Korea as an incentive to dismantle its nuclear weapons program. The promise marks a U-turn in the Bush administration's approach, which had ruled out any negotiations to reward what they described as Pyongyang's nuclear blackmail. The abrupt change in policy comes after increased fears from some in the Bush administration that the deepening crisis would complicate Washington's objective for an early war against Iraq. 17,000 General Electric workers are staging a two-day nationwide strike to protest GE's decision to force employees to pay more for their health coverage. GE is the nation's most profitable company. On the strike's first day, a woman was killed while picketing near a GE appliance factory in Louisville, Kentucky. She was hit by a police car. Louisville police say the incident is being investigated. In other news from corporate America, Kmart has announced it plans to eliminate 37,000 more jobs and close 326 stores. This comes less than a year after the retail giant laid off 22,000 workers. The Associated Press is reporting a total of 115 unarmed Palestinian children were killed by Israeli soldiers last year. That is twice the number that died a year earlier. Meanwhile, AP found that 36 Israeli children were killed in the bombings or shootings in 2002. In Venezuela, the opposition movement seeking to push President Hugo Chavez from office has scaled back its demands for lifting a 44-day-old general strike. The Washington Post reports opposition negotiators have dropped their demand that Chavez resign before new elections. They're now focusing on whether a non-binding referendum scheduled for February 2nd could be used to set an early election date. At an Air Force base in Louisiana, a hearing was held yesterday to determine the fate of two U.S. pilots who killed four Canadian officers in a bombing raid in Afghanistan. Eight other Canadians were injured in that bombing. If the pilots are court-martialed and convicted, they could be sent to prison for 64 years. Lawyers charged the pilots' judgment was impaired because they were taking amphetamines prescribed by the Air Force. The so-called go pills, which are illegal in the United States, help pilots stay alert for 10-hour flights. The casualties were Canada's first since the Korean War and have angered many there. Human Rights Watch, in a new report, is strongly condemning the United States for overlooking abuses by allies in its so-called war on terror, including Pakistan, China, Saudi Arabia, and some Afghan warlords. The group warned that repression in the name of security would backfire, breeding resentment of the United States and its allies. And the Federal Bureau of Investigation has begun visiting Iraqi nationals living here in the United States and plans to visit many more if the United States attacks Iraq. The FBI has drawn up plans to send agents around the country to contact a lot of Iraqi nationals in the U.S., said one official to the Washington Post. The agency is looking to ferret out potential terrorists and gather intelligence that could help in a war. And a new study on job discrimination has found it considerably helps to have what researchers described as a white-sounding first name when looking for work. Resumes with such names elicited 50% more responses than ones with black-sounding names.
Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks that separates whites from blacks? Choose sides, run for your lives. Tonight the riots begin. In back streets of America, they kill the dream of America. Little black girl gets assaulted, ain't no reason why. News prints a story, racist tempers fight. Next day starts a riot, knives and guns are drawn. Two black boys get killed, one white boy goes blind. Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks, separates whites from blacks? Choose sides.
Across the line, Tracy Chapman here on Democracy Now's War and Peace Report. Today, January 15th, is Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. He was born in 1929. He would be 74 years old today. Younger generations know Dr. King as the country's most prominent civil rights leader. But King's opposition to the Vietnam War and to U.S. foreign policy in general has been erased from mainstream history. In his speech, Pachem and Terrace, King spoke about his support for the movement against the Vietnam War.
I certainly welcome the opportunity to say a few words about the costly, bloody, and futile war in Vietnam. If in my remarks statements are made that are critical of my nation's foreign policy, this must not be construed as a rejection of my country. I criticize America because I love her and because I want to see her stand as the moral example of the world. The war in Vietnam is more than a local conflict taking place on Asian soil. It is a nightmarish struggle that involves and threatens a whole world. I cannot help but feel that the present crisis in the Middle East is indirectly related to the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. War anywhere intensifies the possibility of war everywhere. When major world powers flaunt the authority of the United Nations and embark on unilateral courses of action, they open the door to similar action on the part of other nations in situations of conflict and tension. Now, this is not to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front paragons of virtue, not to overlook the role they must play in a successful resolution of the problem. While they may have understandable reasons to be suspicious, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. The maintenance of peace requires a promotion of justice, and for almost 75% of the world's population, justice requires development. When progress and development are neglected, conflict is inevitable. We of the West must come to see that the so-called wars of liberation, which loom on the world horizon, are attempts of the people of the undeveloped nations to find freedom from hunger, disease, and exploitation. They need not entail the violent overthrow of governments if these governments are sensitive, non-oppressive, and non-corrupt. The war in Vietnam has played havoc with the destiny of the entire world. It has torn up the Geneva Agreement. It has seriously impaired the United Nations. It has exacerbated the hatred between continents, and worse still, between races. It has frustrated our development at home, telling our own underprivileged citizens that we place insatiable military demands above their most critical needs. It has greatly contributed to the forces of reaction in America and strengthened the military-industrial complex against which even President Eisenhower solemnly warned us. And finally, it has practically destroyed Vietnam and left thousands of American and Vietnamese youth maimed and mutilated, and exposed the whole world to the risk of nuclear warfare. Since the United States is the most powerful nation in the world and superbly equipped to take the risks for peace, I would hope that this conference would call upon her to take the initiative in ending this ominous war in Vietnam. Finally, let me say that I am more convinced than ever that war is obsolete. There may have been a time when war served as a negative good by preventing the spread and growth of evil forces, but the destructive power of modern weapons eliminates even the possibility that war may serve as a negative good. President Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war, or war must put an end to mankind. And it is my great hope that we will put that end to war all over. Thank you.
Dr. Martin Luther King in his Pachem and Terrace 2 speech, speaking out against war. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we talk about the war at home. Death penalty opponents are asking state officials around the country to follow the lead of outgoing Illinois Governor George Ryan, who recently commuted the death sentences of all 167 prisoners on Illinois' death row. The Republican governor was a longtime supporter of the death penalty, but he became convinced the system is broken when it emerged that 13 people who'd been sentenced to death were innocent. In Pennsylvania yesterday, the American Friends Service Committee urged Governor-elect Ed Rendell to halt any executions of the state's 244 death row prisoners. Rendell said he's not likely to call for a death penalty moratorium in Pennsylvania, but that he would review the issue. Critics say the death penalty is applied unfairly to Pennsylvania's African Americans. More than half of the state's 244 condemned prisoners are black. Today, we will hear from Pennsylvania's most famous death row inmate, Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking on Governor Ryan's decision. Mumia Abu-Jamal has been on death row for 2 decades after being convicted in 1982 of killing police officer Daniel Faulkner. A journalist, Black Panther Move member, and outspoken critic of police brutality, racism, and the death penalty, Mumia Abu-Jamal has repeatedly proclaimed he is innocent of the charges. Over the last 20 years, Mumia Abu-Jamal has written regular commentaries on local and national world affairs. This commentary was recorded on Sunday by Noel Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project.
Governor George Ryan, in the last passing days of his first and only term, saved the best for last. He sent shockwaves across the nation when he issued 4 pardons to men sitting on the condemned units of the state's prison system, opening the doors of the dungeon for 4 men, one who sat in the shadow of the gallows for nearly 2 decades. Speaking in a soft Midwestern accent, his words were as damning as the death sentences that his orders negated. "The system is broken," he said. With these words, he ushered 4 men, Stanley Howard, Madison Hobley, Aaron Patterson, and Leroy Orange, from the darkest corners of the land into the light. Quoting a tale of that famed Illinoisan, Lincoln, he recalled the job of the nation's chief executive, who, reviewing execution orders for those who were convicted of violating the military code during the Civil War, asked one of his generals why one young man had no letters in his file from any who wished his life spared. The general, shrugging his shoulders matter-of-factly, said, "He's got no friends." Lincoln, lifting his pen, remarked, "He's got one friend," and pardoned the man from the clutches of the hangman. Ryan said those 4 denizens of death row, each having been subjected to police torture, falsified confessions, prosecutorial misconduct, and judicial blindness to these vile transgressions, had one friend and decided to cut the Gordian knot by issuing full pardons to the 4 and proving a friend to men who had few real friends in the dark, deserted abodes of death. Before day's end, 3 of the 4 walked away from the closed cell of state repression into the fresh air of a windy Chicago and freedom. By so doing, Ryan has dealt a serious, crippling blow to the state system of death and the inability of the dignitaries and officials of the system to cure the serious problems of the death penalty were shown in sharp and stark relief. It is fitting that Ryan, a one-term embattled politico and a non-lawyer, "I'm a pharmacist," he repeatedly insisted, would be the one to solve these deep and troubling problems. It's equally fitting that the problems of the Illinois death system came to light not through the members of the bar, but through the meanderings of students of journalism whose investigations led to the ultimate conclusion voiced by Ryan some years later: the system is broken. Hours after his unprecedented announcement of the pardon package, Ryan's office would announce another earth-shattering event: the full commutation of every man on death row in the Prairie State. By the end of the week, 167 people would no longer be on death row. Elected as a conservative Republican who never gave a moment's thought to the rightness or morality of the death penalty, Ryan would be the last politician one would expect would strike down the nation's 7th largest death row. With a harsh voice, his nervousness evident by his fidgety presentation, the one-term governor struck a mighty blow against the death system in America. Exercising a breadth of vision that is truly remarkable in an American sitting, albeit departing, politician, Ryan spoke of the problems facing not just those condemned to death, but in the processes, prosecutions, and judgments affecting those condemned to life. His words were a rare gubernatorial recognition of the deficits in the system entire. He said, "The system has proven itself to be wildly inaccurate, unjust, unable to separate the innocent from the guilty, and racist." His commutations of over 160 death sentences unquestionably stays the cold hand of death, but it does not address the injustices that led many to death row, nor keeps them confined on life row. For those problems, those deep cracks in the system remain. It is tragically true that, as Ryan charges, the system is broken. The bitter truth is his efforts, while undeniably noble and unquestionably historic, does not fix the mess. To his credit, Ryan assembled a blue ribbon panel to examine the state's death system, and the commission, after 3 years, came to a political yet systematic conclusion: the system is broken. The commission, composed of prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, and scholars, joined in the report and issued some 85 recommendations to fix the system, including the recording of confessions from beginning to end, the end of jailhouse snitching confessions, which are notoriously unreliable yet influential to unknowing jurors, and a host of other recommendations. The legislature opted to ignore those recommendations, just as the state's highest judiciary chose to ignore many of the most blatant injustices, and Ryan, the non-lawyer, felt compelled to act. If the system is broken, how can the system fix the system? Ryan's very extraordinary act seems to suggest that it cannot. For while those four men are free of unjust convictions, are they the only four innocents on the state's large death row or larger life row? That seems unlikely. In another sense, as the underlying system remains tightly embedded in place, what of those to come? How many years will other innocents suffer in the suffocating holds of steel and brick slave ships, prisons, before another scandal threatens the stability of the system? Like the notorious cycle of police corruption cases that plagues U.S. cities like New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and yes, Chicago, the problem isn't fixed but passed on to later administrations. It seems an abolitionist movement must take this not as a final victory, but as a first step of a systematic battle for real change. We may all agree that the system is broken, but that mere agreement does not ensure that that which is broken will indeed be fixed. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Sarah Jones. Stay with us.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row. A crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels. A ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup. Those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth. And I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber.
Johnny Cash, The Mercy Seat, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Illinois Governor George Ryan had been a supporter of the death penalty until it emerged that 13 death row prisoners in his state were actually innocent. Well, right now, we're going to talk about the experiences of wrongfully convicted people and talk about this by hearing about a popular off-Broadway play called The Exonerated. A website for The Exonerated reads, "Imagine everything you did between the years of 1976 and 1992. Now remove all of it." Those 16 years were taken away from Sunny Jacobs, convicted and sentenced to death for a crime she did not commit. But her story is not unique, and it could happen just as easily to you. The Exonerated tells the true stories of six innocent survivors of death row. Writers and directors Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen attended a conference on the death penalty at Columbia University and decided to take action. They conducted months of research, interviewing 40 former death row prisoners who were eventually cleared, as well as their families. Based on the interviews, they wrote a play that tells the stories of six of these former death row prisoners. The play has a rotating cast that's included Susan Sarandon and Richard Dreyfuss, Tim Robbins, Sarah Jones, and others. Well, today we're joined in our Firehouse studio by actor, playwright, and poet Sarah Jones. She is currently performing in The Exonerated in New York City. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Sarah.
Thank you.
A little about Sarah. After winning the 1997 Grand Slam Championship at the famed New Yorican Cafe, Poets Cafe, Sarah Jones' career took off. Her solo show, Surface Transit, was the centerpiece of the first New York Hip Hop Theater Festival and later won the Best One-Person Show Award at HBO's Aspen Comedy Arts Festival. Spike Lee cast her in his film Bamboozled. She starred in the celebrated Vagina Monologues off-Broadway and in Los Angeles and was featured in PBS's award-winning City Life series. Variety's named her one of the top 10 comedic talents of 2000. Entertainment Weekly named her one of the 100 most creative people in entertainment. Time Magazine called her a person to watch in the same year she was Ms. Magazine's October cover girl. Sarah Jones recently wrote and performed her second solo show, Women Can't Wait, at the United Nations for the International Conference on Women's Rights. Most important, it's great to have you right here in the Firehouse Studio of Democracy Now!
It's great to be here.
Well, I guess I first saw you a few years ago in that first performance of The Exonerated with Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins. And most importantly, the people that you were all playing were in the audience.
That's right.
Tell us about this play.
Well, just having a play like this that sought to bring an issue that, you know, many people don't think of as connected to their lives to off-Broadway stages was itself something very unusual. You know, the average theater goer, somebody who can afford to pay $55 a ticket to go out and see something like this, or, you know, even be able to afford the discount tickets, may or may not be, you know, sort of well-versed in the ways of the criminal justice system and how many innocent people find themselves in circumstances where, you know, they're either locked up or worse, expecting to be executed for something they didn't do. And I really didn't know as much about it as I've now learned being a part of it. I remember one of the cast members when I performed it with the folks you mentioned was Charles Dutton, who was himself, you know, he's not only a wonderful actor and director, but he also knows a great deal about our criminal justice system, our penal system. And I think the play, what Bob Balaban, who's the director, and Eric Jensen and Jessica Blank are trying to do is to use this artistic form as an informative tool. And it's working. I think, you know, it's very telling that much of the news that we're hearing now about the death penalty, you know, is also sort of connected in many ways to this emerging in the popular culture in this way. It's out. It's being performed in L.A. As you mentioned, it's got a celebrity cast. And we know that sometimes we have to, you know, engage folks who have access to a little more power because of their celebrity status in order to raise awareness about these things.
Tell us about the woman that you play, the real life woman.
The real life woman that I play is the, I play a couple of characters in the piece, but my main role is Georgia Hayes, and she is the wife of Robert Earl Hayes. She's, of course, you know, a human being in her own right, but it happens that she is married to a man who was unjustly accused of a murder and sentenced to death row. And I think one of the other interesting things about The Exonerated is how much it, without being, I think, heavy-handed about it, because you don't have to be heavy-handed. All you have to do is lay out the facts. But it not only illuminates just the grave injustices that are, you know, sort of par for the course when you find yourself in the criminal justice system, whether we're talking about the Rockefeller drug laws or, you know, the ways in which women are, you know, particularly poor women find themselves in circumstances where they're either forced into prostitution or end up involved in some sort of drug activity and are, you know, just punished in incredibly disproportionate ways. It highlights that this is part of the war on poor people and working class people, part of the war on people of color, part of the war on women. You know, the criminal justice system is one of the most potent means, I think, that the state can use to criminalize and, you know, justify its actions in treating these huge groups of people with such brutality, but, you know, sort of saying, oh, well, they're not law-abiding citizens. Well, when you got prosecutorial misconduct as rampant as it is, I mean, it's amazing if you actually take the time to learn about these things, just how bad it is.
We're talking to Sarah Jones. Yes, she's here in our Firehouse studio. You also have been performing as immigrants, about immigrants in America. We've been doing extensive coverage about what's happening to targeted populations in this country, immigrants in this country, and how many hundreds of them are being rounded up right now, and definitely under siege from the Immigration and Naturalization Service and other federal and state authorities. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little about your play and then actually perform it.
Well, it would be my pleasure to give you a little sort of sense of what Waking the American Dream is about. I wrote it. It's a commission for the National Immigration Forum, which is an advocacy group that tries to work not only at the grassroots level but also on policy to raise awareness about some of the injustices that immigrants face on the whole. But they're also, of course, particularly post September 11th, just dealing with, a web of issues that, I'm not sure everyone's aware of. And if it isn't, if people don't have access to programs like Democracy Now!, which all too many people are sort of getting their news through, USA Today or Mick Paper or whatever these kind of corporate conglomerates are calling news, and you're not hearing the reality that, many of our neighbors, if we look at the fabric of American society, the thread running through all of our history is that we all came here either as immigrants, a generation ago or five generations ago or 10 generations ago, whether it was, slavery or whatever else it was that brought us here. We all got here as immigrants of one form or another, unless we're Native American. So I think it's interesting that I've had people say, oh, well, you're doing the immigrant thing now. I sort of want to say, no, this is a play about our current society as much as it is about immigrants specifically. Think about your neighbors and your coworkers or your loved ones, and you're probably going to find some immigrants in there. But Waking is something that I've performed around. It has 12 characters in it. And I had the good fortune to perform it in a couple of different spots, once actually for members of Congress. I'm really trying to use this, again, in maybe this a similar way to the ways I've used Surface Transit, Women Can't Wait, or the way a show like Vagina Monologues or The Exonerated serves to entertain people, but also hopefully to create dialogue about issues that are relevant to our lives. I would probably be remiss if I didn't let the characters themselves jump in and take over here. And each of the characters that you're going to hear is based on real people with whom I've met, some of whom I know in my life or that I had the good fortune to interview. And I'll let them take over. You're going to hear from a few people from Waking the American Dream. Huh.
Well, first I would like only to say good morning for Amy Goodman. Thank you very much for having us, the immigrants, to come in your program here. My name is Mitzi Kerlhammer. I have met Sarah Jones because she is wanting to talk about this experience of the immigrant. So I think for me, having of the German background, I want people to realize when I came in this country, I'm 87 years. People say I look quite a bit younger than that, dear. But still that I am coming of this generation of the immigrants who, when we were coming in this country, I like for people to know that they were saying the same things about us, the immigrants, at that time that they say about the people now. We are dirty. We don't want to speak the language. We are only sticking together. We are causing troubles in the Depression or staying in the ghettos. All this kind of things they say about us. And now I have lived to see that the younger people, they are now to thank me. Oh, I am such a good American. Oh, thank you, Mitzi. You have helped to build the America. So I want to say to them, thank you. This is a late thank you. But that now they want me to join them in complaining of the immigration of today. So for me, this is a hypocrisy. That's what I tell the younger people. They are no different than I was at that time. So if you are happy I am here, you should be happy that you have people who are coming here to contribute. That is what I have to say only. So I will stop talking. You don't want to hear more from the old lady. Okay.
First I want to just take one moment to thank Mitzi for that. My name is Muhammad Ali. I do tell people, you know, after 27 years in this country, when they say to me, Muhammad, your name, it's Muhammad Ali. I say, yes, that is my name. They are saying to me, oh, do you float like the butterfly, sting like the bee? I want to tell them that, well, if you will think outside of, you know, then you're looking at the rest of the world. Muhammad, that is a very common name. So I am not the Muhammad of the boxing, but I do tell people that as Pakistani-American, as a person who is coming here to only to work and raise our family without fear of war, political persecution, many of the things that we are facing, I do tell people that one thing is making me so very frustrated is that I have, particularly after those tragic events of September 11, that I must continually try to face those challenges of how do I tell my colleagues and friends. For example, I am an accountant, and I try to tell them that my religion, it is not represented by the action of few twisted madmen. They are hiding behind distortion of Islam. So how do I explain to people that they should not fear me? They should not have that ignorance of me, that I am still that same guy, Muhammad, that they like to play the golf with, that they like to ask me about my food, what I'm eating. Sometimes it can be very difficult to explain to people that I am American too. We are immigrant here, but we contribute here. We are trying to be part of that American dream. So why they will stop us in the road, harassing us? I have many friends, many family that are attacked by their own neighbor. And if they do not have to fear that attack of their own neighbor, where they are paying those taxes, then they must also to have to fearing the police. This is a terrible thing. I want to tell them I am contributing in your police benefit. I am sending you my contribution, monetary contribution, to show that I am part of this. But still, I will be stopped in the road. Why I am in this place, what is my paper, and this kind of thing. So it is very frustrating. I know that the country is going through a very hard time, but must not blame those people who are working hardest, really trying to work hardest to make sure that we are all feeling as though we are part of family. Don't attack your brother, your cousin. That is who I am to people here. So that all I would like to remind people when they see someone that is different. This does not mean they should fear.
Peace, everybody. My name is Bao. I know we're talking a lot about just different, you know, people's perspectives and everything on what it is to be an immigrant. One thing that's real hard for me, it's like, you know, it can be real frustrating, like, you're Asian American, but people are like, wow, your English, man, it's so good, you know, like, it's like, oh, all right, you know, I'm American, you know, like, I'm Vietnamese American, like, you know, I speak English. I guess, like, for me, as a poet, the best way for me to express it is in a poem. So I'm just going to give you this poem real quick. This is not an Asian lotus blossom love poem. This is not an ode to Bruce Lee or Dustin Nguyen or a celebration of my American accent. This is not an authentic immigrant experience piece for PBS. It's not that Vietnamese American honor student returns to Saigon with his Anglo wife, brought to you by Toyota and La Choy. This is not a special presentation right after Nova and before Frontline, sponsored by viewers like you. This is not a teary-eyed reunion story, a video diary for MTV about finding my roots and then eating them. This is not a model minority poem about hard-working straight-A students who find freedom on TRL. This is not the part where I get drunk and sing folk songs with my white frat brothers or win an Oscar for Crouching Tailor, Hidden Dry Cleaner.
This is not the scene where I share ancient Chinese secrets. I'm Vietnamese, remember? This poem, it's not supposed to make you happy or comfortable. It won't fold your shirts, but it may air your dirty laundry because this poem is about boats and memories and my mom never going back, about napalm and crack and long, cold Phillips nights. This poem is about hoodies and knife fights, about minimum wages and searchlights, about representing for hip-hop and Fudong. This poem is about my raised fist and my loud voice and my mother keeping our names by choice, about every Asian American girl I've heard say, "Oh, but my face is too fat," or "I wear the contacts because my eyes are so boring." This is about that stereotype that my sisters are just good for scoring. This poem has no chip on its shoulder, but it has fire in its eyes. It's for Bill Maher saying Asians can't drive and for John McCain calling us gooks. This poem is a slur-proof shield and an arsenal of anger to wield every time someone wants a medal for me because they've feng shuied their pad. This poem is for the Vietnamese history chapter my school never had. This poem is a beginning and a middle, a flood, an affirmation, a cry and a riddle, a warning, a bruising, a coming apart, a pain before healing, a window, a start. Thanks.
Well, my name is Roseme Sylvains. I'm Haitian American. I want to say I know the character from the play Waking the American Dream. We're talking a lot about what is our different experience. And I just want to read you one small piece of something that I wrote. It's a response because I am very happy to be a very, very, very proud of my journey that I made to come on this country. But I want to tell you about one certain real estate man. I met him when I was first trying to buy the house I just moved in. I live in Florida in Miami. And this real estate man on Miami is telling me when I first go to see him that he don't think he have something for my price range before I tell him how much money I have. Then he said to me, "Miss, I think I should refer you to someone you will be more comfortable with." When I ask him, "Do I seem uncomfortable?" he's telling me, "Oh, miss, please, there is no need to get upset." It was very strange, not very nice. And he think I'm stupid. You know, he think I don't understand him, but I heard what he is whispering to his real estate people when he talk on his phone. He say to me on the phone, "Some of these immigrants, they have a lot of attitude. After everything this country have been through, it make me sick." I want to tell him, "Hey, I am American too. I'm citizen. I've been through it too. You want to know what make you sick? How about you come here, you have to leave your family, they attack and kill for your father's small newspaper in Haiti. Then you live 1 month, you have come in with the boat at sea. Then when you come in on 1 month, detention and quam. They put you on detention like criminal. You stay on that detention. When you release, you're grateful for the opportunity. You work every job you can find very, very hard. And you love this country. You save all your money 11 years, so you will have money for down payment for a house. And when you go on real estate, they keep telling you they don't have something on the white neighborhood for you. I want to tell the real estate man that. But I know some people, they say we immigrant, we have reputation for always complaining. So I don't say nothing to him. I just don't give him satisfaction. I thank him for his time. I buy my house with someone else. My new house."
That was Rosa May from Waking the American Dream. This is Sarah Jones cutting in to let one last character share, or maybe two, very quickly, some of the diverse experiences. But I want you to know that what you're hearing is an improvisation based on the piece, which is actually set at a poetry reading of folks who have gathered because one of the only places they feel they can safely share what they've written, particularly immediately post the tragedies of September 11th, which is when the play is set, is in an environment where other people can understand what it is to be a new American. With that, I'll let one more voice come on out, or maybe two. My name is Pauline Ling.
I have to tell you that before I met the Sarah Jones, we were talking about this. What is the problem of to be an immigrant? If you are Chinese American like me, I live in New York City. I experience a great deal of this kind of just discriminate people who they think that you will be a stereotype as soon as they will hear you talk, or they don't have some way to understand. You are a human being just like them, but they don't have a Chinese friend, or they don't have someone that will help them to see we're not so much different, except in ways that should celebrate. This is a positive thing. So my problem is that I try to tell my kids they don't have to worry that there's something wrong with them because they're Asian American. That's something that is advantage for them. They have to celebrate that they have these two cultures. They have two cultures that make them more strong. But I know some people, they will say, oh, these immigrants, they don't want to be American. They only just want to stay in Chinatown, or they only want to just help their own business. That's not true. We contribute a lot of different things to this culture in this country. And I think that one of the things we contribute most is that when immigrants come here, we have to learn a lot of new things, sometimes very new things. It's hard, but we do that because we love this country. And I have learned a lot of different things. But one thing that has hurt me the most is that I think if we don't have the opportunity to talk to each other, we will never know that we have so much things to share in common. So when I talk to this girl, Sarah Jones, that's, I like to do that. We have opportunity to talk to each other, just find out some things that we know in common together. I think if people have the chance to do that, they should always take that opportunity. Then when you see someone in stereotype movie, you will know this is just make up from Hollywood. This is not real person. If you want to know the real person, you have to talk to a real person.
Hi, my name is Manuel. And I just, well, I think that there's a lot of people that maybe they don't realize how much the war in the immigrant, if you're Salvadoran or if you're coming from maybe some other different Latin background, or even if you're coming from any one of those backgrounds, what we don't know is that there's a lot of politics that's happening there. And they will say that they are making this security for the country, but I think that a lot of the times they're just having their own agenda. Because if you look right before everything that happened, there was a lot of talk that Bush is going to make the amnesty for the laborers. And all of the sudden, after he realized this is not part of his new attack on the terrorism, he changed his mind, and suddenly we're now the big enemy, and they have to pour more money on the Border Patrol, they have to pour more money on the INS and all of these kind of things. So I think that there's the politics that we have to realize. And one of the things that for me is really the saddest part is that we now find ourselves even more together in the same boat. And by that, I will leave you with one poem to explain exactly what I mean. This poem, it's a short thing that, well, let's just say that it's about this time that we're living in. And I think that there's a lot of people that can relate to that, unfortunately. And we just have to try to stay strong. So here is the poem for all of us to try to remain optimistic. They followed me home, the boys in black. Their suspicions were fueled by a tragic attack. But this time, it was not my last name that they feared. This time, they pursued me because of my beard. "What's your real name?" they asked, saying my permit looked worn. "Where are you really from? Where were you really born? We have reason to believe you are not who you claim. You came out of that shop with the Arabic name. As I silently cursed my weakness for falafel and explained that I was not involved in anything unlawful and that my olive skin came from Salvadorian jeans and I had been meaning to pick up some razors and shaving cream, the cops were finally convinced that I told the truth and they moved on. But I thought about some innocent youth of Middle Eastern descent who they might question next. And I thought about this country that they're trying to protect. But how many mistakes are made, we have no way of knowing. I could have been one just for letting my goatee grow in. It's strange to be Latino and find now my safe haven is speaking Spanish and making sure I stay clean shaven. Thank you.
Sarah Jones, Waking the American Dream. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we want to talk to her about the FCC, why the Federal Communications Commission calls her work obscene. Stay with us.
Throw him in jail and they kept him there, hoping soon he'd die. That his body and spirit would waste away, and soon after that his mind. But every day he's born a fool, one who thinks that he can rule, one who says tomorrow's mine, one who wakes one day to find prison doors open, the shackles broken, and chaos in the street. Everybody sing with free, 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 free. Everybody sing with free, 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 free. Everybody sing with free, 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 free.
Tracy Chapman, Freedom Now, here on Democracy Now! With Sarah Jones. I was just saying during the break that you have performed a miracle. We only have room for three people here at the table. And I want to wish Uri Gallet, our director, a very happy birthday, because somehow we managed to get a lot of people in and he's not even mad. Thank you. Wow, to see the transformation before my eyes. Incredible.
Thank you.
Did you interview many, many people to accomplish this?
I interviewed quite a few, but, you know, happily, and again, to echo what I was saying earlier, there are so many immigrants, you know, people who have been here either one generation or their parents are immigrants, that in my life or in all of our lives. I mean, particularly if you live in an urban center like New York, but increasingly wherever you live, you know, immigrant stories are our stories. So it wasn't that hard to kind of reach into my Rolodex or, you know, my phone book and call people and say, hey, can your mom, you know, meet me for lunch? Remember that story you told me? Can we talk about that?
Well, your talent is enormous.
Thank you.
And thank you for sharing that with us. Tomorrow at Columbia, there is an FCC hearing. Democracy Now! Will be there live. Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, will be up there, will be co-hosting from there. He, in fact, will be giving one of the speeches there. He'll be offering testimony before the commissioners of the FCC. Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell, head of the FCC, will be there. I'm not sure if that strikes fear in your heart, Sarah, but can you talk about what happened to you on our beloved community station out in Portland, KABU, Portland, Oregon?
Thank you. The interesting thing about this, about the censorship that I'm facing as a result of an FCC ruling, is that to me it's very much connected to Waking the American Dream, to The Exonerated, to Surface Transit, and Women Can't Wait, the other two shows I've written. It is about all too often the state, but also the state in partnership with corporations, working to ensure that only certain voices are heard, that our freedoms are restricted on sort of every front. And so that means whether you're expressing your political beliefs or, you know, trying to make sure you're heard as a member of a group that's typically marginalized, such as, you know, immigrant groups, or if you're a woman or whoever you are, it seems like right now the trend is to make sure you don't have access to other people. You can't share your ideas. And I made I had the audacity to share my ideas over the radio, well, through KBOO, playing a poem that I had written called Your Revolution. And Your Revolution, I should say, is a tribute to Gil Scott-Heron's poem, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. But what it is really is I had been listening to a lot of music. I'm a hip-hop fan. I'm a hip-hop head. I grew up, you know, listening to that music in particular, among other kinds of music. But one thing that really struck me was how I just sort of noticed the takeover of hip-hop music and culture, so that it no longer represented, a voice for people who were sort of, making a way out of very little. Were you using when their, after school programs were no longer funded because of Reaganomics or whatever, and there were no musical instruments, people got out two turntables and a microphone and explored dance and visual art through graffiti. All of that culture, to me, was disappearing into, this sort of corporate it was this commodified, mess that was suddenly branded Viacom, MTV, all of these corporations were taking it over for profit, and unfortunately also using it to spread messages that I think are antithetical to what hip-hop was originally about, which is, freedom and justice for a lot of people. Now it's about misogyny and, materialism and bad words, talk about women that are demeaning and disgusting. So I was listening to all of this on the radio. Lyrics of.
I should say, by the way, unfortunately, that is one word that is allowed by the FCC.
Isn't that amazing? You can use a word that denigrates women because that doesn't offend anybody, right? Who are we?
Well, anyway, maybe it's the same reason why you were fined.
Probably so. But to get more to the point, the culture that I loved so much and that I was sort of seeing mutate into this other thing was what inspired Your Revolution. So I basically took lyrics that I was already hearing on the radio and recontextualized them so that instead of, hey, baby, I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do that to you, and this is all you're worth to me, I said, no, you're not going to do this to me, no, you're not going to do that, and I'm worth more. I'm a human being, not just the sum of my, body parts. And people loved it. I was astonished. I recorded it independently, but the next thing I knew, it was on radio stations, and we know how hard it is to get radio airplay in this moment of clear channel, 1,200 stations all the same, all the time. So I was thrilled. I never dreamed that my song, out of all the songs that play on the radio all the time, would be the one to, incite the sort of, in my opinion, political riot that ensued. Basically, somebody called in, said that it was indecent, and a hearing, or I guess, I don't know exactly how it works, but basically the radio station has to then... We have 10 seconds. The radio station had to respond. The FCC said, we know you think it's a feminist song, but we think it's offensive, and you can't play it. $7,000 fine, and on and on and on.
It was appealed? Is it on appeal now?
Well, we're appealing it now, and people can go to yourrevolutionisband.com to learn more.
Sarah Jones, thanks for gracing
You're
us
welcome.
With your presence.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Jones, and if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, Orlando Richards and Simba Russo are our filmmakers today. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. We'll be live at the FCC hearing tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. One who thinks that he can rule.